WNYC Studios is supported by AT&T, offering a guarantee covering both wireless and fiber internet service that is all about having your back. Staying connected matters. That's why AT&T has connectivity you can depend on, or they'll proactively make it right. That's the AT&T guarantee. Visit att.com/guarantee to learn more. Terms and conditions apply. Visit att.com/guarantee for details. AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And by the way, before the news, we were talking about gentrification and de-gentrification in the current economy. Don't forget to keep adding to our halted development map. It's the latest chapter of your uncommon economic indicators. You can click through our website and add your observations and anecdotes about cranes that are now on pause throughout the city or vacant luxury apartments that are going unsold. Do you live near a building that never got finished? Or do you live near a building that got finished but is sitting largely vacant? We are mapping this throughout the metropolitan area. So we want to know how halted development is affecting your community. Go see our halted development map and add to it at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Since we were just talking about development and gentrification, I thought I'd throw that in right now. But the most creepy part of the New Jersey corruption allegations may be the attempted sale of a human kidney. 58-year-old Levi Itzchak Rosenbaum of Brooklyn was charged with trying to arrange a kidney donation for $160,000. As the Star Ledger reports it, the surveillance tapes show the informant in the case met with Rosenbaum in Tinton Falls last year, looking for help for a friend's fictional uncle who had kidney disease. Rosenbaum told the informant, "Let me explain to you one thing. It's illegal to buy or sell organs. You cannot buy it. What you do is you're giving a compensation for the time, whatever," unquote. So that's in the criminal complaint. Rosenbaum was recorded explaining about finding a donor in Israel and stated that, quote, "there are people over there hurting," referring to people willing to sell one of their organs, and said, "one of the reasons it's so expensive is because you have to schmear all the time." Now, schmear in this case, I guess, refers to bribes, not to spreading cream cheese on a bagel. So joining us now is UC Berkeley medical anthropologist Nancy Shepper Hughes. According to the Daily News today, she was responsible for bringing Mr. Rosenbaum's suspected activities to the attention of the FBI. And even if this kidney sale did not actually go down, there is a dark world of international organ smuggling, which, just as the suspect said, involves people all over the world who are hurting enough to be exploited into selling parts of their bodies. And as a leading authority on international organ trafficking, Professor Shepper Hughes is going to take us into this dark world. So thank you very much for coming on WNYC today. Hello.
Hello, Brian.
So you went to the FBI with your suspicions about Mr. Rosenbaum back in 2002, according to the Daily News. Is that correct?
That's correct. I had begun to unravel a huge network, a criminal network. It really looks like, smells like kind of a mafia that was originally the head office or the pyramid scheme originated in Israel with brokers placed in Turkey, in New York City, in Philadelphia, in Durban and Johannesburg, in Recife, Brazil, Moldova, all over the place. And I used my ethnographic investigative skills to just go country hopping to try to connect the dots. And eventually it brought me to Isaac Rosenbaum being the head broker for Elon Perry and in Israel, who is the Don, basically, of the operation and is a slippery guy. The Israelis tried to nail him and arrest him. They tried to get him on tax evasions, and he escaped to Germany. I think he's back in Israel. The South African police who I worked with, they were also, their hospitals got involved in this, and they tried to go after the top. So it's the very top man they can't get. Rosenbaum was the broker, the main broker for the U.S. operating out of New York.
And here is Ralph Marra, the acting U.S. attorney in Newark, a announcing the indictment of Mr. Rosenbaum yesterday.
Connected to the money laundering, we have one defendant, Mr. Rosenbaum, who we refer to as our kidney salesman. As set forth in the complaint, his business was to entice vulnerable people to give up a kidney for $10,000, which he in turn would turn around and sell for $160,000.
Wow, Professor Shepard Hughes, that's a pretty high markup.
Yeah, well, that's been a very stable fee that he's charged. It has been as high when the scheme gets investigated and has to move from one place to the next. It goes up and has been as high as $200,000. But occasionally these brokers, you know, feel sorry for people who can't come up with all the money, and they bring it down to as low as I've heard maybe $130,000. But, you know, when I went to the FBI, that's not something that, an anthropologist would ordinarily do. But I was so angry after making a trip to Moldova and finding out that collapsed villages in central Moldova, little towns where young men, 15, 16, 17 of them per village, were being tricked. Not only were they recruited, but they were being told that their jobs would be house painting and working in hotels. And so the first bunch of them didn't even know. They were naive. You know, they would get to Turkey, or they'd get to, even some Moldovan peasants slipped into the United States. And they were selling their kidneys under coercion, under force. And I got angry about Rosenbaum because someone within his organization in Brooklyn contacted me, had a crisis of conscience, and he wouldn't give me his name. He called himself, David Hamilton. I knew that wasn't his name. And he said, look, I'm an employee in this organization, which I thought was legitimate. And he said, I'm just disgusted by it, and I'm frightened, and I don't know how to get out of it. Can you help me? And he explained that he was the one that was processing these people who were trafficked in. And he said many of them were coming from Israel, but they were newly arrived Russian immigrants who were frightened, who were sometimes, as they arrived from Russia, were picked up at the airport by the brokers in Israel and said, look, we can help you, you know, settle in to get your, you know, your right to stay here, but you have to do a little favor for us. First of all, you have to come with us to New York City and just give up a little kidney. And so they were coerced, and when they would get to New York, they would be frightened. And they'd say, I can't go through it. I never heard of such a thing, selling a kidney. I don't want to go to the hospital. And then my insider from the organization, which called itself something like United Lifeline, he said, then the guns would be put on the table. He said, this guy Rosenbaum, he carries a gun. He said, I'm with dangerous people. And he said, I'm a religious person. I just want to get out of here. So, you know, he gave me quite a bit of information, but he refused to meet with me. But between this and having several people who I interviewed in Israel who came into the United States, as well as going to other parts of the world, but I'm focusing here in the United States, told me the names of the hospitals, and they were our best hospitals.
And did they know in the hospitals, Professor, that they were performing kidney surgery on people who were really unwilling participants and were being exploited and threatened?
My sense is, how could some of them not have known? The people that arrived, some of them, they didn't speak the same languages. They were poor, they were disoriented, and, and then the patients who were receiving these were also from another country. Why didn't they sit there? We have rules. We have, transplant coordinating committees. We have ethical guidelines. And you don't just let people walk in off the street. Both of them, and in the case of Moldovans, the sellers were coming from one country and the buyers were from another. And just say, everything's okay. And this, I even have footage, of a video of a young man, I think he has maybe even some mental problems, but he basically came to Mount Sinai in 2006, and he films himself going through an illegal operation through a broker in Brooklyn.
He recorded this? on tape.
Yes, he has it on his own tape. He did
and
a home
says
movie.
At the time that he's an unwilling participant?
No, he was not unwilling. He was a willing seller, but he wanted to actually demonstrate how easy it was to get inside Mount Sinai Hospital and have a very superficial screening while he's trying to film the doctors who are asking him, are you doing this of your free will or whatever, and saying, would you put that, you know, camera down? And then, you know, he can't film his own surgery, but he films himself after surgery with his huge, humongous scar. And then he says, I felt like used meat after it was over. I was out of the hospital in 2 days, and then I'm in this nasty little hotel room, and I'm plastering $100 bills on my head, saying, what have I done to myself?
Has that video ever been screened or released?
Well, I have a copy, and I brought it to 60 Minutes and was surprised they didn't want to use it. I guess the quality of the film is a little shaky. It's not. And I showed it at the New York Academy of Sciences, a bit of it, last September, to let people know, you know, in New York City, and there were some people from Mount Sinai there. They couldn't believe it. But, they believed it because they recognized the doctors, they recognized the hospital, and they saw that, you know, this guy said, I just came, I met a broker in Brooklyn, and, you know, I sold my kidney to him. So not all of it is coerced, but it's all against the law.
If you have that on a file, we'd love you to email that video to us. But my guest is Nancy Shepper Hughes. She is a medical anthropologist at the University of California at Berkeley. And if you are just tuning in the middle of this incredible story that she's telling, she is the person who originally tipped off the FBI to Mr. Rosenbaum, who was arrested as part of this corruption and money laundering sweep yesterday in Brooklyn and New Jersey, and charged with trying to be a kidney dealer. And we can take your phone calls on organ smuggling at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. If you tipped the FBI off to him in 2002, why was he only arrested yesterday?
I don't know. I don't know. I did try to contact the agent just last year to say, I know, you know, you're not allowed to really tell me what's going on with your investigation, but it's been a very long time, and as far as I know, people are still coming in and they're still using Rosenbaum, there's an agent in Philadelphia, and I went to Philadelphia and I met with that agent, and he was a very interesting man, a rabbi himself, and he claimed that he didn't realize that this was a criminal organization and that he just, you know, thought that he was helping people out, sort of like, getting them settled in. And he thought that Isaac was a good man, probably making money on this. But so I confronted the hospital, which was also an excellent hospital, Albert Einstein, and I said, look, I've got the charts here of a dozen Israelis who have come and have been illegally operated on in this wonderful academic hospital in your unit, using a broker in New York City and using donors they had never met, and they lied and said that they were relatives. Sometimes they didn't speak the same language. What were you doing there? Well, I was ushered out. I mean, it was a very closed meeting, and I was trying to be very discreet. I knew the names of the doctors because the patients told me the names of the doctors. One of them was sitting at the table. And I was really given the bum's rush, as you can imagine. How dare you? How dare you accuse us of this? And I I just thought you ought to know about it.
These are very, very serious charges, and I think we will reach out after the show today to Albert Einstein Medical Center, to Mount Sinai, and invite them to come on and tell their side of the story. But go ahead. Did you want to finish a thought?
No, that's all. And it's as I said, I also have been tentative, and I have not published my book because I was so afraid of making any kind of a false accusation, which is why I tried to reach, people who I thought could do a more thorough investigation, like the FBI. And, you know, my I was motivated because of the damage that this was doing to very, very poor and desperate people, either because they're new immigrants and they're frightened and they're looking for a toehold, or because they're economically destroyed, as these people were in Moldova. And then I got really angry when, and I know some of the brokers in Israel, the lower-level ones, Ilan Perry at the top always, you know, puts the phone down and won't talk to me. But the same group got into northeast Brazil, one of the most impoverished areas within, you know, Latin America, and were working, and I've spent many years in Brazil, recruiting, you know, guys who were unemployed and, you know, water carriers, people who were, you know, living from just hard scrabble hand to mouth, and they took these guys and brought them all the way to Durban, South Africa, another set of brokers related, you know, and then brokers in Brazil who are also from the Israeli scheme. And so one of them I interviewed in jail as well. I worked with police both in Brazil and in South Africa. When I reported to them, they didn't like the reports. I always reported to the ministries of health. I tried to go through medicine. I tried to go through the transplant organizations in those countries.
Why not law enforcement?
It took a while.
Why not law enforcement? Why not law enforcement?
Well, you know, I was desperate in the New York scene because I tried to get 60 Minutes involved. In fact, one of their people met me in Israel. I introduced them to people who said that they had bought kidneys in Philadelphia, New York, and San Francisco as well, by the way. And they didn't want to do the story. And so I said, well, if they're not going to do it, I mean, I'm not used to going with police, you know. Then I'll go to the FBI, and I was given this contact, and we met in the Roosevelt Hotel, and I showed all of the data. Now, why it took so long, that I don't know.
And
all
that
I
was,
know is
that
when
was
I went through...
That was 2002.
That was 2002. Now,
and
when
did
I
they,
went to Brazil,
before you do the next part, did the FBI contact you in the recent days or weeks and say,
we're
going to finally bust
ago.
Your guy, Rosenbaum? Yeah, what'd they do?
Well, the New York people did call me a couple of days ago. Now, I don't know if they're related, and they probably are, and maybe they work together with the New Jersey, office of the FBI. So they did, and they said, now we're getting involved really full-scale into an investigation. And I said, I laughed. I said, but you had all the information in 2002. I think people can't believe it's true. They just couldn't believe that something that seems, you know, when you first hear it, this is grotesque. This has to be, you know, a science fiction story. This can't be real. But what annoyed me is that Brazil took a little bit of work to get it across. And in South Africa, I had the help of the head of the transplant association there, who then gave the information to the police. And the police in both Brazil and South Africa did stings, you know, within a year at least of getting the information.
My guess?
Giving talks all over the world about, well, you know, there was a sting in Turkey. I also was involved in a sting with another member of the group in Turkey, which was a big site where these operations were having. Well, they at least arrested the doctor, you know, he got out of jail, it didn't stick, but they responded. And I say, and then in Brazil and South Africa, they really got involved in it. And I say, then people say, well, but it happens in the United States. And I say, but I can't get the attention of anybody.
Well, I think now you've got people's attention. And my guest, if you're just joining us, is UC Berkeley medical anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes. She's one of the experts in the world, one of the leading experts in the world on organ smuggling, and says she tipped off the FBI in 2002 to this man, Rosenbaum, who was arrested yesterday, who the FBI described as our kidney salesman as part of that sweep in New Jersey and a little bit in Brooklyn that netted 44 people. But not everybody sees these issues exactly the way you do in all cases, and I think one of them may be Dory in Nassau County, who's on our phone now. Hello, Dory. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I don't know how I see the issue. I see a lot of complexities, but this past week, I believe, the New Yorker magazine carried an article on transplantation. And they were discussing the possible pros of organ selling, in that more people would be willing to donate, and possibly you might have more people donating on a free basis, as happened with blood. I'd like to hear the doctor's comments on this.
I'm glad you brought that up, Dory, and that New York article is not the first one recently to raise the question whether voluntary buying and selling of organs should be permissible around the world. Do you see any circumstances, in your opinion, Professor, where you think it should?
Yeah. Well, this is an old argument, and it's been much debated in the medical literature and the human rights literature and so forth. And there's one country where for 15 years they have allowed four people within that nation to buy and sell, and that's Iran. It's an odd case, but they simply decided that in both Islamic countries and in Israel, in a Jewish country, there's a similar feeling about not defiling the body at death. And so in this wide arc of the Middle East, it's very hard to do anything with transplant except with living donors. And so there have been proposals in Israel at one time to try to have a regulated system, and that's what you're talking about. Iran has it. The problem is it's a hard thing to regulate because doctors are not going to run it. Who's going to find the people to sell? So instead, they have runners who look like the kidney hunters that were working for this big criminal network that we're talking about, that was working in Brooklyn and many other countries. So it looks the same way. They go into the highways and byways, and they look for people who are desperate and unemployed. And I can't see how it can be a good system for the society. And I've had members of my organization, graduate student medical anthropologists, go to Iran to observe it, is that it results in this resentment after the fact of people who are getting what's not called, you know, payment. It's called compensation. They get like $1,800. But they know that behind the scenes, the younger, the more attractive donor meets the buyer, and the buyers say, well, if I can get that nice, healthy, vegetarian, college-educated student, I'd rather have that one rather than some scummy, you know, street person, and we'll pay $15,000 to get that. So behind the scenes, it's still brokering. And also, it creates almost like class warfare, because it's almost invariably, unless you want to pay $30,000, $40,000, and then you can get a college student, the state's not going to do that. So, you know, you have the poor people saying, well, isn't my kidney worth as much as this college student who managed to get $15,000 or $20,000? And also, is it really something we want transplant surgeons to do, to take a relatively healthy, hopefully, because sometimes they're not, person, you know, carve them up, take out an organ, and I don't like slippery slope arguments, but now in China, it's livers, half livers. Okay, you can live, that's true, with one kidney. If you're poor and you're a factory worker or a farm worker, or you're lifting heavy objects, as many of the people at Seoul in the Philippines that I've met, or in Eastern Europe and in Brazil, they lose their jobs afterwards. They say they lose their energy. I mean, if you're maybe a computer worker or, you know, a secretary, or and you have excellent health coverage and you're also screened well, you know what I'm saying is we could have an experiment with it and see. But I don't think it's good for medicine. I don't think it's good for society. And there are other solutions to this, I think. We have to.
And you know what? We have to take a very short break. But when we come back, I want you to tell us what you think the solutions are to it, and whether you think this arrest in New Jersey yesterday could be the key to really blowing this up into public view in a more serious way, which it sounds like you've been trying to do for years and years and years, and bring about some policy change. So we'll continue for just a few more minutes with Nancy Shepherd Hughes. After this, Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So would you sell your kidney for money, listeners? Would you buy a kidney if you needed one from someone who is a willing seller? 212-433-WNYC. Why don't we answer that ethical question for a few minutes? Would you sell your kidney for money if you needed the money? Should the law prevent you from doing that? If you needed a kidney, would you buy one rather than just wait for a donation? 212-433-WNYC, or post your answers to that question at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. 212-433-9692, or WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show as we talk for another few minutes with UC Berkeley medical anthropologist Nancy Shepherd Hughes. According to the Daily News today, and she's been confirming it here for the last half hour, she was responsible for bringing Mr. Rosenbaum's suspected activities to the attention of the FBI. He's the one who was arrested yesterday and called by the acting U.S. attorney in Newark, our kidney salesman, as part of that international money laundering and corruption sweep in New Jersey and Brooklyn. Let's take a phone call. Doreen in Brooklyn. Doreen, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have certain views on this buying and selling. I myself had offered to donate my kidney when I saw a heartrending ad asking for a kidney in our newspapers here. And I was turned down. But as far as the selling, I don't know what these do-gooders of the world, those do-gooders of the world are messing up people who, on the one hand, who need some money, need money desperately, and they are willing to give up a kidney. People who are desperately in need of a kidney and are willing to pay for it, what's their business to butt in and the government to butt in? I don't see anything wrong with that. I see nothing wrong with somebody having such a transaction.
Professor Shepherd Hughes, talk to Doreen.
Well, I don't know quite how to respond to that, because I've probably interviewed a few hundred people who had sold a kidney, and all of them regret it after they've done it because they feel that they were not treated well. They weren't. They were treated as though they were living cadavers.
So let's
they
say
didn't
get
enough money to make it.
Let's say you're going to get somebody, and that would not be an issue. You know, you happen to have somebody who would regret it. Of course, once you don't have a kidney, maybe you wish you still had it, and you could sell it now and make money again.
Doreen,
who knows what reason.
Doreen, let me ask you a question, because
yes.
I get the sense that you're from an Orthodox community. Do you think that to avoid pleas for people like you who are living and healthy to donate a kidney, and to avoid the kind of buying and selling that we've been talking about in this segment, that it would be proper to revisit the question of whether organ donation after death should be permissible under Jewish law?
You know, I don't know why you're going into a totally side issue, even calling me Orthodox.
Well, our guest,
you don't call Christians, when I say they're Christians, whether they're Catholic, whether they're Protestant.
Well,
but somehow the media always talks about Orthodox Jews. They don't talk about Jews.
Our guest had raised the issue earlier, and different people are observant at different levels, and this is why I understand that our guest brought up that it's an issue in Israel, an issue of debate.
Well, at this here point, we're not talking about that. I myself just responded to a plea of desperation for somebody who needs a kidney, and I wanted to donate, and they didn't even tell me why they turned me down. I assumed that it was because I did say that I had and was recovered from cancer, and maybe my age.
Right. So
it was over 55.
To protect your health.
I beg your pardon?
To protect your health.
I don't see
That's
why.
Right.
I understand you can live with one kidney.
Yes. Okay. Anyway, Professor Shepherd, go ahead and respond to her one more time.
Yeah, you were well screened and well protected, and that's great. Look, the problem is not that easily solvable. Kidney disease is widespread. It's a democratic disease. It attacks people who are wealthy as well as people who are poor. The problem is this. Once you have a system of compensated or paid donation, then people do not offer to help members of their family or loved ones. And that's what I heard again and again in Israel. Better to buy from a stranger. Why would I harm someone in my family? Now, let me tell you something else. Of all those people on the waiting list, 70,000, you know, I didn't check today. It goes up every day. One of the explanations that people give is that no one in my family matches me. And that's baloney. That's an alibi that the doctors give to family members who on the side say, look, I don't feel comfortable. I love my wife. I love my sister and brother. I love whoever it is. But I don't really want to give a kidney. And so the doctor says, it's okay. I'll say you don't match. And the reason I say it's baloney is because people go all over the world to get poor people. And I'll tell you, populations like gypsies in Eastern Europe have been really hard hit. Afro-Brazilians in Northeast Brazil have been hard hit. If we're worried about tissue matching, forget it. They don't bother to do the tissue HLA tests. They just say if your blood matches, you're good enough. And so why is it that so many people say, oh, but nobody in my family and nobody in my close, dear friendship network matched me? Mm-hmm. That is just not true.
And Doreen, we really do appreciate your call. And let's go to Matthew in Great Neck. You're on WNYC. Hello, Matthew.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to say that I've actually, I am a transplant recipient multiple times over, and I have waited on the kidney list. Fortunately, I'm not waiting at the moment. But I've been there. I've waited, months for transplant and whatever. And I just find, I've always found the idea of paying for kidneys morally repugnant. I know what it is to be a donor family. I've obviously been in touch with people. It's an incredible gift. And I think the real problem is not the economics of it. I think the real problem is that there's huge misconceptions over the process of donation, over the idea of, who can give, who can't give, if there's any religious obstacles, which there are not. No major religion bars transplantation or donating, I should say. And I think that's the real problem that UNOS faces. And, unfortunately, the media doesn't seem to help. There's always, you always see in the news articles or news stories about botched transplants and so forth, and you see it on TV all the time. And I think it just generates this fear and these misconceptions, which are really, to me, the real obstacle behind greater donation rates and transplantation in general.
Matthew, thank you very much. And let's get the voice of one doctor who's calling in, David in Manhattan. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you? Nice to be here.
Thank you.
Some countries have a thing called the opt-out system, where everyone's a donor by default. And if they wish to opt out for religious or personal reasons, then they have a tattoo or an ID card or a tag, and they are opted out of the system.
You're talking about donating after death.
Right after death. Let's say there's a car accident, et cetera, et cetera. Because the way it is now, when someone dies in a hospital, you have to track down family members and get permissions during this very difficult time, which is very, very difficult and often doesn't happen. So if you had an opt-out system in America, like some countries have, then you have all the organs you need for donation and research.
You'd automatically be an organ donor upon your death unless you signed a form to opt you out of that system.
Do you think
Professor Shepard used that's a key as you look for solutions to illegal organ smuggling?
The key that's worked in many countries in Europe. I just came back from France. France takes care of all of it, has a very, very short waiting list there. It's a smaller country. 7% of all of their transplants with kidneys, now we're talking about, is using living donors. They don't even ask family members to do it. They say, no, we have enough. We manage with deceased donors. Now, in the United States, many, many transplant surgeons say, no, we have 70,000 people. No matter what, we'll never have enough deceased donors. One of the problems, I hate to say it, is that the UNOS waiting list needs to be culled a little bit. There are many, many inactive people listed. There are people who are multiply listed, people who we have a regional system. And so if you have a doctor in five different regions, and some people do that, you can be on five kind of separate regional waiting lists. So that 70,000 is a bloated figure. Who are the inactives? The inactives are patients who doctors among themselves say, we can't possibly transplant this person, but they desperately want to be on a waiting list, and we don't want to, you know, there are people who are too old, too sick, too frail, multiple problems, and yet they're listed. So one of the things is that we don't have, and this question of 15 people dying a day of, you know, who are on dialysis, some of them are 85 years old. You do have to die at some point. So we really have to have more honesty and less propaganda about people dying on the waiting list.
And
the system works.
Okay. And just before we go, because there's been some discussion of prohibitions in Judaism against donating organs at death, Andrea and Park Slope has a different take on what that really is. Andrea, real quick, thanks for calling.
Hi. It's not a take. It's a misconception that Judaism prohibits organ donation. It is not prohibited to any Jew. In fact, it is imperative that you become an organ donor after death because you're saving a life. And for more information, I just heard a speaker on this. That's why I wanted to call. He's an Orthodox Jew. And if you go to the Halachic Organ Donation Society, Halacha is the Jewish law, HODS.org, you can read all about it, and you'll see pictures of bearded rabbis saying that it is absolutely acceptable, permissible, and in fact laudable to donate organs after death. And many Jews think it's not, and this mission of this organization is to fight that misconception.
All right. Thank you for calling in, and I think we're going to have to do a follow-up segment on this next week and clear up what is and what is not permissible under Jewish law with respect to organ donation after death, and if there are different versions of it in different communities or whatever that is.
But can I just comment one thing on
take
that?
Take 30 seconds, and we're done.
It's absolutely true that every Jewish bioethicist, and in Israel, every, using the word Orthodox bioethicists say it is absolutely a good thing, you know, to be an organ donor. The problem is cultural. The problem is at the level of the family and sometimes the local rabbi. But it's officially, it's certainly considered to be, you know, a meritorious act in Judaism as well as in Islamic traditions and Christian and really Buddhist. All of the religious leaders say it's a good thing. The problem is at a cultural level.
Well, this has been a really fascinating conversation, and we will follow up on that. We will follow up with the New York hospitals who you named, who may be wittingly or unwittingly engaging in transplants of organs that were smuggled or dealing with people who have been coerced in one kind of international ring or another. But my guest has been UC Berkeley medical anthropologist, one of the leading experts in the world on organ smuggling, Nancy Shepherd Hughes. She is the person who tipped off the FBI way back in 2002 to the man who was arrested yesterday as part of that sweep in New Jersey, 58-year-old Levi Yitzchak Rosenbaum of Brooklyn, described by the U.S. attorney as their kidney salesman. This has been really fascinating. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we'll meet a woman who's trying to do one green thing every day.